The Federal Reserve has been raising interest rates lately in an effort to combat inflation. But should the Federal Reserve have so much responsibility over our economic well-being? Our guest today argues that the U.S. relies too much on the central banking system, and he offers some solutions for a more stable way to manage the economy. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about the Federal Reserve and the U.S. banking system? Do you support what the Fed has done lately to keep the economy afloat during the pandemic? Do you worry about mission creep since the Great Recession and the pandemic? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Lev Menand is an associate professor of law at Columbia Law School. He's a former U.S. Treasury official. His new book is The Fed Unbound, Central Banking in a Time of Crisis. Lev, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
You spent a whole chapter on this, Lev, but let's start with the basics. In a nutshell, what is the Federal Reserve supposed to do? What is its main tool to do it?
Federal Reserve was founded in 1913 to perform a limited purpose, to administer a system of investor-owned chartered banks, banks like J.P. Morgan Chase that we know today, Bank of America, Citigroup, and to ensure that the banking system collectively makes enough money for everybody to use. And the money that banks make are called deposits. Banks issue deposits and they expand and contract their balance sheet. They issue more or fewer deposits by extending loans. And the Fed's job is to ensure that the amount of bank money, the amount of deposits in the economy is sufficient for the economy to operate at full potential. That means maximum employment, price stability, and moderate long-term interest rates in the long run.
We talk sometimes about the Fed's job being to control inflation and to maximize employment and reduce unemployment. As you write it, and as you just said it, that's kind of like a secondary outcome. If they're doing that first thing right, making sure there's the right amount of money in the economy, those other things should, in theory, follow?
That's exactly right. And this is a common misconception throughout Washington, throughout policy debates. The Fed's mission is not employment directly. It's not price stability directly. It's not the Fed's job to ensure that inflation is always 2%. The Fed's job is monetary. It's to ensure that the amount of money in the economy is consistent with long-run stable prices, long-run full employment. And Congress thought when it created the Fed and when it gave the Fed that mission, which was in 1977, that there were a lot of other government agencies who would have to work on things like addressing supply shocks that might cause inflation to be high today or promoting full employment. The Fed's job was monetary. It was a piece of the puzzle, not designed to be the sole macroeconomic agency of the federal government.
Still a pretty big job. But then along comes the financial institutions collapsing that caused the Great Recession. And as you write it and as you chart it, the Fed's job got way, way bigger. What happened?
Yeah. So what happened is over about a 40 to 50 year period, accelerating in the 80s and 90s, the banking system really deteriorated. So the Fed was constructed to manage a system where banks are producing most of the money. Bank deposits are the main monetary instrument. And what you have is the emergence of a shadow banking system, an unregulated set of financial companies that wants to copy the bank business model but not play by the rules, not follow bank regulation. And they emerge and they get quite large. And some of them, listeners will be familiar with, like Lehman Brothers and Bear Stearns, ran into a lot of trouble in 2008. And Lehman Brothers filed for bankruptcy. And these shadow banks by 2008 were playing a major role in the monetary system. But the Fed wasn't designed to administer them, control them, oversee them in the way that it was designed to administer the banking system. And this has just created a world of pain, both for the Fed and for the American people since 2008. And unfortunately, in 2022, we still live in an economy where shadow banks play a major role and the Fed is trying to stabilize them without the right set of tools to do so.
Yeah, and they were kind of improvising tools, you write, back in 2008. What kind of things did the Fed do to extend its toolkit awkwardly to deal with the collapse of some of these shadow banks?
So the Fed aggressively interpreted its legal authorities and set up a variety of ad hoc lending facilities to try to provide the same sort of backstopping that is sort of coded in the law to provide for the banking system, to provide that for the shadow banking system, to ensure that the money, basically, the cash substitutes that the shadow banking system was creating, that those would be exchangeable for cash. So if you think about it, the reason you're willing to hold a deposit instead of government-issued cash is because if you go to your bank, you can get cash for it. There's that that convertibility. And that convertibility, banks are only able to do that because of a whole system the government has set up and the Fed standing behind it, making cash available to banks if they need it. That system doesn't exist for shadow banks. And so the Fed sort of, they jury-rigged a system like that in 2008 so that all of the shadow banks that were issuing their own sort of cash substitutes, there was runs on all of those institutions and they didn't have the cash. And so the Fed tried to make the cash available to them to stop the runs and prevent the entire financial system from basically freezing up.
Talking to Lev Menand about his new book called The Fed Unbound, Central Banking in a Time of Crisis. You can join in with your questions, your reactions at 800-642-1234 about the role of the Federal Reserve. And do you think Congress should be more at the center of managing economic problems like, say, inflation? Call 800-642-1234. Okay, Lev, the goal here of these improvised tools from the Fed to prevent a full collapse of the financial system, it worked, right? We had a great recession. We didn't have a great depression. So what's wrong with what the Fed did?
So two things. One is there's a qualification on it worked. The Great Recession was great because it didn't actually work that well. We had a much sharper downturn. We had what might be called a hard landing because of the financial system's malfunctions in the fall of 2008. So it took the Fed a while to get the situation under control. The failure of Lehman Brothers and panic in various parts of the financial market meant that credit provisioning froze up, and that meant that hundreds of thousands of people lost their job and ultimately millions lost their homes, a circumstance that was preventable in the sense that this was a product of dysfunction in the monetary and financial system. It wasn't because of a natural disaster like a flood or a pandemic. It was because the system didn't work properly. And that is a catastrophe. And it's an own goal for the U.S. economy. And so the first caveat is it only worked. It worked, but not as well as it should have. The other issue is that the Fed only able to backstop this system when it runs into trouble. And the dynamic effects of that over time are very problematic. The distributional impact leads to financialization, huge financial profits. The financial sector is able to privatize its gains from risk-taking during good times and then turn to the Fed and the government when things go wrong during bad times. And we also have this dynamic now where, since the Federal Reserve has put its balance sheet to use in a big way, expanding it trillions of dollars to support this shadow banking system, there's now increasingly demands from across the political spectrum for the Fed to adjust its balance sheet usage to further other social and political goals. So the Fed has really put itself on the map as a major political actor outside of sort of fine-tuning the money system, now that it's clear that it can lend outside the banking system in a big way.
We're talking to Lev Menand, Columbia law professor, author of the new book. We're talking about The Fed Unbound, Central Banking in a Time of Crisis. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What kind of economic policies would you want to see from a president, from a Congress, from the Federal Reserve? Are you worried about growing influence, maybe overreach of the Federal Reserve? Do you think that we need reforms to the banking industry to consider some of these shadow banks our guest is talking about part of the banking industry? Call in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions for our guest. That's 800-642-1234. 1234, or you can email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Columbia Law Professor Lev Menand. His new book is called The Fed Unbound, Central Banking in a Time of Crisis. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions about the Federal Reserve and how we manage our economy, whether there's too much pressure on them to do it. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's bring on a caller now. Mark is with us in Appleton. Mark, hi.
Hi. Hey, thanks for taking my call. So 20 years ago, at the turn of the millennium, the national debt was $5.5 trillion. It's now $30 trillion. The Fed balance sheet was $500 million. It's now $8 trillion. And all of that extra stimulus has worked its way into the financial system to do one thing, and that is to make the economy bigger. My question to your guest is, how will we know when the economy has gotten big enough?
Mark, thanks for the call. Lev?
So the goal of the Federal Reserve is historically to ensure that there's enough money in the economy to allow everybody who wants to work to get a job and all the productive resources of the country to be productively employed. And so economists at the Fed spend their days trying to figure out what the economy's full potential is, how many resources are available, and what would it look like if they were fully employed, all being used? And if they were all being used, how much money would there need to be in the economy? How much money in credit? And are we above or below potential GDP? They create projections, and then they try to set policy as a function of those projections. The actual debt of the government and the actual size of the balance sheet are only indirectly related to the Fed's efforts to ensure that the financial system is creating enough money and credit to keep the economy's resources productively employed. And one thing that we do know is that over the last 15 years, we've not been growing at our full potential, and that we've repeatedly been missing to the downside. And that's part of why many Americans over the last 15 years have perceived the economy as not being as good as the economy that their parents grew up in, and have generally negative perceptions of the economy, because we've actually been missing to the downside year after year.
Mark, thanks for the call. That balance sheet, though, Lev, the Fed and the chart in your book is a really quite impressive, not necessarily a good way, how much more the Fed is holding in various kinds of debt that it's picked up and other things.
Yeah, so historically, up to 2008, the Fed's balance sheet was a sort of passive variable in Fed's policy. It was however big or small it needed to be based on how much physical cash people, ordinary households and businesses in the economy needed to conduct their day-to-day transactions. And so if Americans needed more cash, the Fed would create more physical cash and give that cash to banks, and that's how the cash would enter the system. And so it wasn't used as what we would call a policy variable. Fed officials didn't get together and say, let's grow the balance sheet. It just grew or shrunk based on how much cash people withdrew from banks. Starting in 2008, when the shadow banking system ran aground, the Fed started to expand its balance sheet actively as an active variable in a way that wasn't actually related to how much cash people needed. And so you see the Fed's balance sheet grow from $900 billion, which was mostly about how much cash was in the economy, physical cash, to trillions of dollars. And those dollars were digital dollars. They weren't physical cash circulating in the economy. They were ledger entries on the Fed's books that it used to buy financial assets, securities. And this was a transformation in how the Fed used its balance sheet. And one of the things that I argue in the book is that a lot of this transformation, including a program called quantitative easing, was a byproduct, directly or indirectly, of the Fed's efforts to stabilize the shadow banking system, something that the whole legal framework for money and banking in the U.S. Doesn't sort of anticipate would exist, but does exist, and the Fed needed to figure out some way to keep it from completely imploding.
Thanks for that call, Mark. We'll go to Jim now in Cedarburg. Jim, hi.
Thank you. I'd like to know the role of savings and loans back in the 70s and 80s, especially how were they viewed in this whole scenario about the amount of deposits that they maintained. They were, you know, I remember the 3-6-3 rule, and, you know, they were the backbone of neighborhood economies. What happened to them with the creation of these investment banks in the 80s?
Jim, thanks for the call. I remember, Lev, the SNL, the savings loan scandals and collapses. Briefly, where do they fit into this picture?
Of course. Terrific question. Mm-hmm. So when I've been using the word banks throughout this call, I've been referring to, there's actually a collection of different chartered banks and different types in this country. And so there are chartered commercial banks like JP Morgan, but there are also savings and loans, thrifts that are federally chartered. And there are thrifts that are state chartered. And there are credit unions, and all of those entities maintain deposits. And so all those deposits are part of the money supply. They're part of the instruments people use to store value and to conduct exchanges. And so the thrifts are part of the banking system. And up until the 90s, we had a very diffuse, decentralized banking system. So we had thousands of commercial banks, we had thousands of thrifts, and we had thousands of credit unions. And there wasn't like one or two huge ones that dominated. The savings and loans crisis of the 1980s was a function of a number of things, but one of them was regulatory differences between the thrift system and the banking system, and regulatory competition, loosening of standards. So managing within the banking system has historically been a problem. The rise of shadow banking has interjected a whole new dimension. Because here's a new competitor for all of the different bank types that we have under the legal regime that's not even within the sort of traditional legal framework for banking. And so the 90s and the aughts are the story of the emergence of all these other types of entities, as well as a sort of related change in the law of how the regulated banking system worked that allowed for conglomeration. And so you have the emergence of major financial conglomerates and very, very large banks, and the concentration of the banking system in the 2000s and the 90s. And nowadays, thrifts are a much smaller part of the monetary system than they were in the 80s, just as the banking system itself is a smaller part of the monetary system. Mm-hmm. In about 2007, 2008, half the sort of money supply was shadow bank money. So deposits were much, much smaller part of the money supply than they used to be.
Thanks for that call. Talking to Lev Menand about his new book, The Fed Unbound. Lev, I want to take our last few minutes and look at solutions. One solution you really point to is Congress taking a more active role in using other kinds of tools. I want to get one, for instance. You talk about options for Congress in dealing with the kind of inflation we're seeing nowadays. What kind of things could you see Congress and the president doing to tackle some of the causes of inflation?
So obviously, monetary tightening is part of addressing certain types of price rises. But we shouldn't look to the Fed exclusively to address inflation, because inflation has a lot of causes, oftentimes non-monetary causes, and the Fed's tools are very blunt. We would be much better off as a society if we could address inflation in a more narrow way, rather than slowing down the entire economy so that supply and demand equilibrate, address areas where supply and demand is specifically out of whack. So there's a couple ways to do this. One is through fiscal tightening. So Congress can raise taxes in areas that are overheating. It can also reduce its own spending in areas of the economy that are overheating. I also think the United States should have industrial policy again. And so there are certain sectors of the economy where supply and demand are out of whack. Healthcare has experienced enormous inflation. Energy has experienced inflation. Housing experiences inflation. So rents are up and housing prices are way up. And the federal government should have a national plan for those sectors of the economy to increase supply, to bring prices back down again. And that's something that Congress used to be more engaged with. And it would be to everybody's benefit, I think, for Congress to turn to that again, as well as to the executive branch, so that we try to increase the capacity of the economy in order to get out of inflations, rather than reducing economic growth to slow inflation, which makes everybody worse off than the alternative.
And in just our last minute, Lev, the shadow banking industry, these bank-like things that aren't regulated like banks, what would you like to see happen?
We have to rationalize our bank regulatory system. In insurance, if you issue a product that looks like insurance, that talks like insurance, that walks like insurance, insurance regulation applies. In securities regulation, same thing. You can't issue stock securities and call them something else and not follow the securities laws. In banking, for far too long, you've been able to copy the bank business model, say you're not doing banking, and not have to follow the banking laws. That has to stop. Fundamentally, we have to change the law so that any entity that does something that looks like banking follows the same rules as all the other entities doing something that looks like banking.
Lev, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Lev Menand is an associate professor of law at Columbia Law School, a former U.S. Treasury official, and author of the new book, The Fed Unbound, Central Banking in a Time of Crisis. He's with us today looking at ways to reform our economic system to be less reliant, he says, on the Federal Reserve.